This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
The title of my talk is a little bit of a misnomer because this is in a way less about Mesmer, although it does include him, than it is about following one thread in the labyrinth of the research that I've been doing towards occult subjects. So it will necessarily not include fiction or film in here, but it will take a necessary pathway leading from Mesmer to psychoanalysis and primarily Freud, and somewhat strangely perhaps to modern physics, perhaps as an acknowledgement or an apology for Mesmer or to Mesmer. I'm not entirely sure, although I'm still negotiating my way along these very strange pathways. What does it mean to speak of the occult or the paranormal in post-Enlightenment culture? Half a century ago, Theodore Adorno wrote a scathing critique of occultism, claiming that it's a deterministic worldview that reinforces conformism in the wake of social and cultural developments in late capitalism. More recently, literary critic Timothy Matterer remarked that interest in the occult may be labeled intellectually suspect or the sign of a budding neurosis. These days, however, hardly a month goes by without the release of a novel or film exploring supernatural events or representing characters with mysterious spiritual and psychical powers, and more than ever, technology has made possible the broad dissemination of New Age spirituality. Indeed, in spite of the fact that many contemporary thinkers, and I include among these Jacques Derrida, Nicholas Royle, and David Punter, to name but a few, many contemporary thinkers have conjured up telepathy, phantoms, and the paranormal as either a source of or a challenge to meaning in postmodern culture. In spite of that, there is still a tendency to view interest in occultist traditions as being pathological or anachronistic and inherently anti-modern rather than cultural narratives that are subject to continuous change under social and historical conditions and which provide insight into the organization of knowledge. At the turn of the last century, social and cultural interest in telepathy, hypnosis, and survival after death was paralleled in the reception of new communications technologies such as the telegraph and telephone, which appeared like other paranormal phenomena to defy the limitations of time and space and contributed to what Pamela Thirschwell refers to as wider conceptualizations of the borders of individual consciousness. In these conceptualizations, the study of the mind linked the question of consciousness to ubiquitous debates on the connections between animal magnetism, phrenology, and spiritualism, the veridicality of ghosts and spirits, the authenticity of mediums, the relativity of time and space, and the possibility of life after death. In this milieu, psychologists collaborated with physicists, phrenologists, magnetizers, and mediums to consider the thorny question of, as Thirschwell says, what separates one mind from another and what separates the living from the dead? After all, we're this close, how far away are the dead? But there were skeptics too, and among them was Sigmund Freud, who in spite of his attraction to the paranormal, his very great attraction, dreaded the confluence of psychoanalysis and parapsychology and was compelled to repudiate all forms of mysticism in the name of psychoanalysis. And I would add to that hypnosis, because that's one of his, even though he said he didn't do it very well, he also said it was too mystical for him. And to disavow what he saw as a new religio-ethical system, these are his words, arising out of his protege Carl Jung's misconceptions and deviations from scientific materialism. In fact, Freud felt so strongly about Jung's secession that he considered himself justified in maintaining that no one can know better than I do what psychoanalysis is, how it differs from other ways of investigating the life of the mind, and precisely what should be called psychoanalysis and what would better be described by some other name. It's this other name that interests me here, because Freud's allusion to it draws attention to his failure, firstly, to impose discursive limits on the meaning of psychoanalysis, when it already would have been, to use Bakhtin's terms, a living word. It was always already entangled, shot through with shared thoughts, points of view, alien words, value judgments and accents having already emerged in a dialogically agitated and tension-filled environment. Beyond Freud's attempts to keep the study of the mind an occult-free zone, the history of consciousness shows us that, in part, psychoanalysis comes into view as an effect of the discursive interactions and collisions between materialism, parapsychology, and, oddly enough, modern physics in what amounted to an attempt to revisit the question, what is mind? This was a question beyond the subject-object opposition promulgated by 500 years of classical science, and I should add, currently beyond what Jacques Derrida identifies as the instituting question of philosophy, what is, or the TSD. In the 19th century, scientists working on the physiology of the mind directed their energies towards explaining the phenomenon of consciousness in terms of the nervous system rather than in psychological terms, even though their experimental data was drawn from case studies involving magnetic sleep. As Adam Crabtree points out, during this time, physiologists applied their methods to search for explanations for not only unwanted or unexpected thoughts or actions, but also other baffling activities of the mind, such as spontaneously produced answers to difficult problems and fully formed creative works that outstripped conscious thought processes. Examining these experiences within the perspective of the organic paradigm, physiologists believed that they could find the answers in the functioning of the nervous system. In fact, by the late 19th century, the new physiological approach to psychology, well, actually, it wasn't really all that new, but it was much more overdetermined, to psychology had all but supplanted philosophical psychology. As the history of science shows us, in spite of epistemological challenges, this sort of materialism has carried over into some areas of contemporary neuroscience, including neuropsychology. However, this same history also demonstrates that is to say, beyond the personal and professional tensions at work between Freud and his protégés, that psychoanalysis, now here's the big claim. This is the big claim, and I can't possibly address it here, but you're going to get a sense of what's driving me mad. Psychoanalysis was also the site of a transgenerational, epistemological, and ontological reworking of a centuries-old question about the connection of consciousness, and thereby about un, sub, super, and transconsciousness, all of the various models that were used during the 19th century, to the brain. The question of whether cognition, consciousness, and the mind are, as Michael Levin describes, byproducts of the physico-chemical processes in the brain, or whether or not mind is a real component of the universe and not being reducible to matter, energy, may be responsible for thoughts, intentionality, consciousnesses, and experiences. Relevant in many contexts, past and present, the question of mind within psychoanalysis indicated a turn in the history of consciousness that Freud mistook for the return of magical thinking that Freud associated with the omnipotence of thought that he found in children, obsessive-compulsive, psychotics, and primitive societies, and he attributed it to animism, a previously surmounted mode of thinking belonging to the prehistory of the human race. And I think arguably you could make some connections between Freud's idea of animism and what Mesmer was trying to do with regards to affecting matter. The return of which results in a strange experience of the uncanny. Instead of the return of magical thinking, however, the question of mind within psychoanalysis, uncanny or otherwise, paradoxically signaled a paradigm shift in modern science that, to use Morris Berman's terms, and perhaps to Freud's dismay, would see mind as being uncannily every bit as real as matter. And you can probably start to see where I'm thinking that we might have to reconsider some of the things that Mesmer was saying. But this view would not be premised on the notion of a sacred unity, nor would it be reducible to the experimental method, nor amenable to positivism. That is, the mind in this paradigm is to be regarded as being immanent in the arrangement and behavior of phenomena, not inherent in matter itself, as in pre-modern philosophy. But then, how is one to understand Freud's concern and fascination with the experience of the uncanny, which is, as Nicholas Royal puts it, ghostly and concerned with the strange, weird and mysterious, with a flickering sense, but not conviction, of something supernatural. How is it, in other words, that this sense of something supernatural, which appears to inhabit psychoanalysis like a foreign body and is linked to the mind-matter question, is bound up with developments in science? Prior to psychoanalysis, Mesmer took a materialist position with regards to the efficacy of animal magnetism as a therapeutic method. Now, a lot of people believe that actually Mesmer was, you know, being condemned for being too flaky, as you put it, but he actually was trying to promulgate a particularly materialist model of what he was doing. However, as Maria Tatar points out, in the decades following the French Revolution, mesmerism escaped the control of its founder, perhaps much the same as what happened to Freud, to become enmeshed with a wide range of mystical, spiritual, and metaphysical doctrines. And Mesmer's theories landed somewhere near the middle of the spectrum, where primitive psychotherapy shades off into psychoanalysis, faith healing merges with Christian science, and ancient superstition blends with spiritualism and parapsychology. In this context, the mind-matter question was also alive in a less materialistic wing, less mechanistic wing of mesmerism, which saw the phenomena of somnambulism as proof that the soul could function apart from the body, thereby removing the chief obstacle to the belief in personal immortality. As for psychoanalysis, the question of mind was profoundly complicated by the fact that it coincided with turn-of-the-century studies in parapsychology, and both of these corresponded with extraordinary developments in modern physics. I refer here to the changes in physics that not only challenged the assumptions of classical science, which privileged the idea of a detached observation, that is, the distinction between subject and object, and therefore between psyche and matter, and to which I would also add analyst and analysand, which Freud was always talking about having to remain aloof from the from his patients. But this challenge also appeared to share an affinity with other systems of thought, from alchemy to mesmerism to parapsychology, all of which were always already repudiated by classical science as being suspiciously mystical by virtue of their seeming to belong to a class of religious ideas that in Freud's view need to be taken seriously as an enemy of science. In the case of psychoanalysis, it's also important to remember, as James Strachey points out, that throughout his entire career, Freud continued to believe that a physical basis for all mental phenomena might be found. The American psychologist and advocate of psychical research, William James, must surely have had classical psychoanalysis already in mind when he remonstrated, "We are surely all familiar in a general way with the sexual theory method of discrediting states of mind for which we have an antipathy." In James's view, this medical materialism was a simple-minded system of thought that finishes up St. Paul by calling his vision on the road to Damascus a discharging lesion of the occipital cortex, he being an epileptic. It snuffs out St. Teresa as an hysteric, St. Francis of Assisi as a hereditary degenerate. George Fox's discontent with the shams of his age and his pining for spiritual veracity, it treats as a symptom of a disordered colon. Ironically, it was a revolution in science that facilitated the correspondence between the study of mind and parapsychology, including those theories of telepathy and clairvoyance, by speculating upon the possibility of consciousness as being a primary element of reality that uncannily, as one physicist put it, may have the power to achieve what is both the best documented and at the same time the spookiest effect of mind on the material world. The ability of consciousness to transform the infinite possibilities for, say, the position of a subatomic particle, as described by quantum mechanics, into the single reality for that position as detected by an observer. But there's more to it than this. David Peet, who's also a physicist, argues that just as matter has its subjective side, as shown through the quantum measurement processes, so too mind has an objective side. So what are we talking about here? I mean, it almost sounds as if we're reworking a lot of the discourses that were going on at the turn of the 18th century. Pete describes the complementarity between the study of mind and quantum theory. Quantum mechanics has revealed a subjective element in nature. The outcome of any quantum process depends upon the way it is perceived by the observer. In a complementary fashion, this is physicist Wolfgang Pauli, believed that this corresponded to Jung's discovery of an objective layer to mind, called the collective unconscious. Matter and mind were both recognized as having objective and subjective layers. They are complementary in their structure, and at the psychoid level, each reflects the other. Each reflects the other. Although this complementary structure challenges what Christopher Hoke refers to as the hard and fast division between mind and matter, science and an examination of the history of science and technology over the last 500 years would reveal that this period witnessed an erosion of the experience, says Hoke, of reality as an engagement of the mental and the material. It's starting to sound New Age, don't you think? Morris Berman refers to this period as the disenchantment of the world, in that it resulted in a model of consciousness that, quote, recognizes no element of mind in the so-called inert objects that surround us. Such consciousness separates matter and spirit, or matter and mind, and equates the measurable with the real. At its peak in the 19th century, however, scientific rationality found itself challenged not only in the aftermath of the Romantic movement and Nietzsche's radical questioning of history, but also from seemingly different quarters, parapsychology and the new physics, which, like parapsychology, was coming to conclusions that did not accord with the common sense, that is to say, materialist understandings derived from mechanistic theories of classical science, which all educated people assume to be, quote-unquote, reality. In the field of parapsychology, influential thinkers such as F.W.H. Myers, one of the founding members of the Society for Psychical Research, coined the term telepathy to describe psychical influence from a distance, or the communication of impressions of any kind from one mind to another, independently of the recognized channels of sense, and thus, to my mind anyway, pose the phenomenological question of alterity par excellence. Whose thoughts are these inhabiting my inner world? The question throws a strange light upon subjectivity as it was hypothesized in the study of the mind, and may serve to remind us that there is more to alterity than the shattering of the autos. Myers, for example, thought that experience of telepathy and clairvoyance gave good evidence of a continuous subliminal self that harbored not only a second, but multiple consciousnesses. In opposition to this view, Freud was convinced that it was merely his use of a physical technique. And this is where it gets back into Mesmer's making the passes. The pressure of his hand on the forehead of the analysand that in response gives rise to a deceptive impression of there being a superior intelligence outside a patient's consciousness. And this unconscious second intelligence is no more than an appearance. In contrast, Myers thought that the subliminal self is able to operate free from the brain in ways that modify both space and time as they appear to the ordinary conscious mind. Furthermore, just as the subliminal self is able to control physiological functions of the brain and body as exemplified through hypnotic experiments, and of course that gets us back to you know who, so it is able to exert force on other physical objects, accounting for levitations, materializations, spirit wrapping, etc. In developing the theory of the subliminal self, Myers, like other thinkers, and these are, of course, too numerous to mention here, Myers appears, unlike Freud, to have incorporated the views of modern physics on the relationship of consciousness to space and time, as well as the notion that the mind of the observer necessarily exerts an influence on matter by virtue of a certain affinity. Moreover, Myers' theory of the subliminal self leads us to reconsider what we mean by subjectivity, because beyond the question of consciousness, it also works to destabilize what Sanu Shamdasani refers to as the singular notion of the unconscious that has dominated 20th century thought. What's important about this historical context is that it reveals that psychoanalysis, and especially the psychology of the unconscious, initiated by Freud and Jung, was the effect of a dialogic encounter between competing paradigms. These heteroglossic forces, if you will, are alluded to by Beverly Zabriskie in her preface to the recently published letters of Carl Jung and the physicist Wolfgang Pauli. This is Zabriskie. It might be said that whereas the Freudian metaphors of psychodynamics are of the 19th century mechanical genre, the Jungian perspective through alchemy and particle physics adds 16th and 20th century metaphors. So that's really quite an addition. That's really quite a formula. What Zabriskie is referring to is the fact that Jung, in collaboration with Pauli, formulated the theory of synchronicity, an acausal connecting principle derived in relation to both modern physics and alchemy, in which matter and mind are not differentiated as in the assertions of classical science. In contemporary terms, the theory of synchronicity can be seen to find its analog in the Lacanian notion of knowledge in the real. As Slavoj Žižek tells it, knowledge in the real is more than a means of illustrating metaphorically a certain feature of psychic reality. The term also alludes to the fact that modern physics, when dealing with subatomic particles, repeatedly encounters phenomena that seem to suspend the principle of local cause, that is, phenomena that seem to imply a transport of information as a form of knowledge. In theorizing the possibility of what he called an unconscious, that is, objective reality, that behaves at the same time like a subjective one, in other words, like a consciousness, Jung drew not only from quantum theory, but also from alchemy, which he saw, among other things, as a science of psychic transformation, calling it also a modern differentiation of the obsolete concept of correspondence, sympathy, and harmony. So we're back into that whole sense of harmony and Mesmer. In the view of classical psychoanalysis, and in today's terms, this constellation is disturbing and even disorienting, and also inviting, of course, charges of flakiness. because as Jeffrey Hartman says, to think otherwise threatens to return us to a magical universe with currents of sympathy running along esoteric channels, the very world described as primitive by Freud in Totem and Taboo, but which paradoxically seems within the purview of quantum physics. Indeed, this is the very world that was disavowed by Freud, and at least since his break with Jung and Ferenczi. It's the world, as Freud argues, of primitive men and neurotics who attach an over-evaluation to psychical acts. I actually think Freud was trying to Jung and perhaps Ferenczi. In view of Freud's materialism, the problem with certain psychical acts or indeterminate phenomena is that if they are not a matter of psychopathology, they are dismissed as being merely mystical. William James summed up the materialism typical of Freud in this way. Phenomena unclassified with the system are seen as paradoxical absurdities and must be held untrue. No part of the unclassifying residuum has been treated with a more contemptuous scientific regard than the mass phenomena generally called mystical. Physiology will have nothing to do with them. Orthodox psychology turns its back upon them. Medicine sweeps them out, or at most, when in an anecdotal vein, records a few of them as effects of the imagination, a phrase of mere dismissal. If such dismissals remain the official case in contemporary thought, it's because, as Jeffrey Hartman explains, Freud has made it hard for us to value interpretations not based on the priority of a certain psychological factor. In Hartman's view, this interpretive model concerns a failure to draw a certain type of experience into that special dialogue established by Freudian psychoanalysis, a failure that occurs in spite of, or perhaps because of, Freud's Fort-Dah relationship with the paranormal and telepathy. Although Freud struggled throughout his career to sever the ties between psychoanalysis and the supernatural, he was always of two minds regarding occult phenomena and the paranormal, displaying what Ernest Jones calls an exquisite oscillation between skepticism and credulity so striking that it is possible to quote just as many pieces of evidence in support of his doubt concerning occult beliefs as of his adherence to them. However, even though Freud appeared to delight in disconcerting Jones on the topic of occultism, Jones said Freud seemed pleased at shocking him on the subject. It is evident that Freud's concern was always to keep psychoanalysis a closed system, uncontaminated by what he calls elsewhere the problems of occultism. Excuse me. When Freud states in a 1921 letter, "If I had my life to live over again, I should devote myself to psychical research rather than to psychoanalysis," it becomes apparent that by putting the matter of his career in the form of making a choice between parapsychology and psychoanalysis, Freud is able to set the two in different camps, as you were, and rhetorically to valorize the distinction between them. Oh, either one or the other. I'm so sorry I didn't do that, but I can still maintain this. So strategically, to retain the association between classical science and psychoanalysis. In fact, as far as occultism was concerned, Freud would only go so far as to admit that there was a kernel of truth in telepathy as being by far the most respectable element in the field of occultism. But even then, he remained very ambivalent about it. The problem, as François Roustang points out, is that psychoanalysis wants to be irrevocably on the side of science and therefore rejects what it cannot account for. In this context, Freud's wistful avowal of a devotion that never happened ironically serves to draw attention to all that the materialist view cannot account for, including telepathy, clairvoyance, and the uncanny relation of psyche to matter promulgated by Jung. According to Christopher Hoke, another problem lay in the fact that psychoanalysis thought it could proceed with the objectivity of a classical science, even though its object of investigation, the unconscious conscious psyche, was itself also the very tool of that investigation. Thus, Freud's apparent nostalgia for a missed career opportunity in parapsychology has the effect of implicitly keeping the study of the mind an objective occult-free zone, as I said, which by definition works to maintain the materialist view that psyche is restricted to the skull. And that when experienced outside this container, psyche must always be a delusion, an error that must be withdrawn back inside. In the first instance, and I'm almost done, the question of containment and restriction reveals an anxiety about borders, about maintaining distinctions between inside and outside, and about fear of contamination by any foreign bodies, or for that matter, by any occult subjects. In the case of psychoanalysis, the logic of the foreign body is instructive, for as Nicholas Royal argues, it articulates how particular institutions, media, texts, discourses, and disciplines are inhabited, haunted, even constituted by what they cannot tolerate, by what they cannot acknowledge, by what is alien, external, contaminatory. No wonder Freud was anxious about maintaining the proper name of psychoanalysis. The other name to which he alluded would return to the science of the mind all of the problems of occultism, all of the problems of the mind, all of the issues of proximity and distance between one mind and another that quantum mechanics was addressing. All of the problems of occultism he wanted to avoid, and these problems threatened to reveal that psychoanalysis and parapsychology were always already haunted, even inhabited by the other. Ironically, for Freud and for classical psychoanalysis, it was to be advances in modern physics that would enable the uncanny and arguably also the precarious rapprochement between the two. Thank you.